tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 6th of May 2026 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I mentioned yesterday we would have a special guest today and today we do indeed have a very eminent person today. We have the Assistant Editor of Heritage and Destiny, Mr. Peter Rushton. Peter, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Sven. It's good to be back. How are you?
I'm excellent. I do enjoy our conversations and I like the fact that we can talk about the Heritage and Destiny magazine when it comes out. It comes out every 2 months. I do recommend people get a subscription to it. It has a lot of content in there that you're not going to find in people's blogs. You're not going to find on people's podcasts. It is an excellent magazine. And of course, it gives me an excuse to record a podcast with you, Peter, which, as I say, I always enjoy doing. Always enjoy doing. Well, I'm only about halfway through the magazine at the moment. At the moment, it started off with an excellent story about Australia, which is basically an Australian nationalist, and he's talking about the history of Australia. And I always find it fascinating when nationalists talk about the history of their country, their nation, because they're so enthusiastic about it, and they always pick up on things that mainstream historians wouldn't actually pick up on. And it's part two at the moment of this Australia story, and I'm really enjoying it. I just wondered if what your thoughts were on that to start off with.
Yeah, Jack's series is excellent. There'll be one or two more parts to come of that. It also reflects something that's very important and has been very important to H&D right from the start, and that is that Heritage and Destiny, right from when it was first created by our editor, Mark Cottrell, when he was living in the USA. He's an Englishman, of course, but was living in the USA. And it was created as a magazine of the Anglosphere, not just a British magazine. So we've always had, obviously, with those historic links to the USA, but we've had links to Canada. We've had links to our old comrades in South Africa and Rhodesia, and our links to Australia and New Zealand. So the entire Anglosphere contributes to H&D, and Jack Van Tongeren's article is an example of that. It's also fascinating that in terms of generations as well, you know, it would probably astound some of our younger listeners that Jack is old enough as an Australian to have fought in the Vietnam War, in the closing stages of the Vietnam War.
Well, he must be quite some age then. We used to have a person on here called Mr. I, and I think he might have been in his 90s. And he was born he was alive in the time of the Second World War. And it was fascinating listening to him. You always get a lot more insight from people that are much older, that have actually lived through these things. So the author was an Australian nationalist. Is he living in Canada now, I believe?
No, he lives in Australia still.
Oh, he's still in Australia. Oh, that is good. That is good. As I say, it's new to me, really, the story that he's telling. I'm aware of Captain Cook and how Australia was discovered, but not how Australia was mapped, what happened to the convicts when they arrived there, talking about the gold rush, the politics that went on between the people and the state. It's absolutely fascinating, and I must say I am very much enjoying that. But as I say, that's not your contribution this month. Your contribution, or one of your contributions, is talking about the formation of the British National Party and a book by Julian Lepert, who I believe was elected as a member of the British National Party. And you are writing a review of his book. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Peter? Because you were part of the BNP at the time, I believe, or just before.
Yes, indeed. It's been one of the best things about this this last couple of issues. The present issue and the next issue is I've had the opportunity to read books by fellow comrades in the movement. One relating to the primarily to the 2000s when Julian was in the BNP, and the other which I'll be reviewing in the next issue. By our comrade Sam Melia about more recent events, of course, in with Sam Melia's imprisonment. But that's a topic for another time. In relation to Julian's book, he came into the BNP just about the time I was leaving it, and was there for the what you might call the best years and the worst years. The years in which they were winning elections, and then the years when it all fell apart, and so it's a fascinating appraisal of those years. With, I suppose you can take very optimistic things from it. You can also take warnings from it. So it's quite a comprehensive guide to our recent past and explaining how we came to be where we are now. Politically, in other words, how we came to be in a situation where we only have quite small racial nationalist parties, and the electoral side of our movement is pretty much dominated by civic nationalists. That wasn't always the case, and younger readers may not realise this, that within, not just within living memory, but within relatively recent memory, 20 to 25 years ago, there was a racial nationalist party, the BNP, winning council seats. Not just the very occasional, any very occasional fluke win, but fairly frequently winning council seats and coming good seconds in others and being a major force in British politics. So that book is it was an extraordinary reminder for me of those times, both of in the early chapters of things I experienced directly from the inside, and then things I experienced later in the 2000s as a sort of semi-detached activist, because of course I'd fallen out with Griffin, but was still in close touch with some other people inside the party, like Richard Edmonds, Andrew Bronz. For the period he was within it, Jonathan Bowden, he was sort of in and out of the party, and eventually victimized by Griffin himself, which is another story again. But it's it on the optimistic side, it shows what we can do when we manage to be united and when we manage to triumph over difficult circumstances. And it's an inspirational book as well as a warning, I think.
Were you, am I correct in thinking that you were in the British National Party when they had the win at Barking and Dagenham? Is that correct?
No, I'd already gone by then. I was in a party called the England First Party by then, and I was around that same time. It might even have been in that exact same year. I was the election agent for our editor, Mark Cottrell, and another colleague of his, Michael Johnson, when they both won elections to Blackburn with Darwen Council as members of the England First Party, which was, I think, 20 years ago this year, 2006. But I was in the BNP up to and including 2002. So I was there at the last election campaign I did with them was in May 2000, the April-May 2002 elections, where I was particularly active in Oldham, which was my home area at the time, and where we did spectacularly well in the five seats that we fought. Didn't actually win any of them, but came a very close second in four of them and a very good third in the fifth. And in that same year, Steve Smith and his lads in Burnley, they won three seats. So I actually met up with Steve and one of those elected Burnley councillors on St George's Day this year, Dave Edwards and Steve Smith. We met up with some comrades in Lancashire on St. George's Day. So it was good to see them and be reminded of that. Not quite the first breakthrough for the party, but it was the election of three councillors in 2002. There had, of course, going further back to, in 1993, been the very first councillor, who was Derek Beacon, elected in the East End of London.
Maybe I'm getting mixed up with Barkin and Dagerman thinking about Derek Beacon, because my next thought was, am I correct in thinking that the Labour Party then pretty much changed the whole demographic of that part of London and imported lots of non-whites so that the BNP would not be able to be voted in again? Is that correct?
That is in effect what happened. Now, whether it was a response to, the cause and effect thing is a little bit complicated there, because part of the reason why Derek won that election is that that process, the early stages of that process, were already underway. And there was in particular a housing crisis in Tower Hamlets, which of course in an area that's now notorious as being completely very heavily dominated by Bangladeshi politics and factions within the Bangladeshi community. But in those days, there was still much more of a surviving, if embattled, white community in Tower Hamlets. And the situation was particularly acute regarding housing. Very reminiscent of the situation today, in a way, except that the people who are under pressure in London regarding housing are, young graduates now rather than the working class sons and daughters of old East Enders who've more or less all moved out. But housing was the big issue. And even the Liberals, the Liberal Democrats at that time in Tower Hamlets, were out of step with their national leadership, because they were sort of semi-adopting some of our policies regarding housing, in particular the question of whether on housing waiting lists for what's now called social housing, what would once have been called council flats, council housing, whether there should be a specific priority given to the sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters of long-standing local residents. And that was the hot issue. And of course, that amounts in practice in the situation that Tower Hamlets was then in the early 1990s, that amounts to a racially slanted policy in effect in those days. If you were saying you will prioritize the sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters of local residents, that meant you were prioritizing white people in effect in those days, because there were very relatively few Asians who'd been there for more than one generation at that time. And that housing issue was what won the seat for us, and it was what pushed strong votes for the party in other parts of Tower Hamlets and in the neighbouring borough Newham. Now, of course, you look at Tower Hamlets and Newham today; those are two classic boroughs where the Labour Party is under enormous pressure from Asian independence, and in some wards from the Greens, because those racial issues are coming home to roost for the Labour Party and damaging the Labour Party. They've dug their own political grave in some ways by encouraging, and certainly, as you say, was it done deliberately to stop us? Yes, there was that combination of cause and effect there. Bringing them in the first place boosted us. That was the first thing that boosted us, because locals were reacting against it. But then in the years to come, of course, when more and more and more came, it just became demographically impossible. And the two factors of mass immigration and gentrification killed off nationalism in inner East London, in places like Tower Hamlets and Hackney and Newham, places that had been strongholds for Mosley's movement, later for the National Front, eventually for the BNP. they were completely killed electorally, because you know there were relatively few. They're still there to some extent, but very, very few traditional white working class EastEnders still around in those areas.
So did they not go with that policy then? There was a policy being suggested of giving the council houses to the descendants of the people that already had council houses. As you're saying, that was in effect. That would have been a pro-white policy. So did they go against that policy then? They went against it
because partly in the shock horror reaction to us winning, the local Liberals were forced to change their policy. The local Liberals were in effect extinguished because of that. They'd been a sort of seen by local voters as the more sort of moderate pro-white choice locally. I'm not talking about the national leadership. But when they came under pressure from the party leadership to change their policy and to become more multiracialist, they were then just pretty much eliminated from the picture. Labour swept in because they really hit the place hard and mobilised both the ethnic vote and the developing gentrified, trendy, wokeist, Corbynist vote, as you might say. We're all heavily mobilised against us.
So I should imagine they then said, well, we've got these non-white people, they're vulnerable, nobody wants to rent to them, maybe they don't speak English, therefore they are vulnerable and we have to house them, and we're going to house them first. So that's effectively what happened.
That's in effect what happened. And one of the excuses that they gave, not just a question of vulnerability, the other excuse they gave was housing need in terms of families, big families. And of course, because this is where the demographic issue is so double-edged for us, because for a number of reasons, cultural reasons as well as economic reasons, their communities encouraged the growth of young families, the very rapid growth of young families, that then pushes them up the housing list. So and of course it's a vicious circle for it from our point of view, because the further they get pushed up the housing list, the more that then encourages them to have more children, and the more it discourages Indigenous communities to have children because they're still living at home with their parents. Housing policy is really at the centre of our cause, because once that's granted, once people have the possibility, and let's not forget, this is why council housing was created in the first place, to try to encourage communities to be able to live together and form stable families, stable communities, and not be massively overcrowded like in the 1920s and 1930s or before then, you know, families all massively crowded together. Thought, well, council housing will encourage people to be able to form families in civilized circumstances. And if people don't have a roof over their heads, don't have some sort of possibility of stable independence, don't have the possibility of a roof over their head without having to work every hour of the day to survive economically, you know, if they don't have that security, they're not likely to want to start families, and who can blame them?
So I guess it's like a vicious cycle there, really, as you were saying. If these white communities don't actually have any non-whites there, then they're not going to become nationalist. I was watching an Edward Dutton video the other day, and he was in a very, very white part of England, and they were all multicultural there. Leicester was nearby, but they would go to visit it during the day, and they liked the different foods and the variety, effectively. But in the place where they lived, they didn't have any. So they were all sort of supportive of multicultural policies. So then when the non-whites come in, then they start becoming supportive of nationalist policies. But once there are some in there, they're going to breed and have larger families. More are going to arrive. And then before you know it, the white demographic has become a minority, and there's no chance of getting nationalist politicians in anymore, as we've seen it happen in Tower Hamlet. So we're talking about voting there, Peter. And You also cover the movement news in the Heritage and Destiny magazine, and you talk about electoral politics, and we do have an election coming up, don't we? So do you want to talk about that for a bit?
Yes, well, of course, it will now be tomorrow when those elections take place across a large part of England and across the whole of Scotland and Wales, because let's not forget, as well as the English councils, there's the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Senate. Now, it's been the case for several years now that electoral politics is not what it used to be for racial nationalists. It's a bit like the Dickens thing. It's the best of times and the worst of times. It's the worst of times for us because we've got relatively few candidates from racial nationalist parties, but every credit to those people who are standing. But in another sense, it's the best of times because mainstream politics is in crisis, and all sorts of forces that are not quite our sort of people, but are not the mainstream either, are challenging received wisdom. You mentioned Ed Dutton a moment ago. In the intellectual sphere, there's that whole ferment with people like the Lotus Eaters and Ed Dutton, all sorts of people like that, challenging establishment views. In electoral politics, there's obviously now just the first stirrings of a breakaway from Farage's party, and let's say a party that's still civic nationalist, but is, I think we'd probably all agree, potentially at least, more genuine as a civic nationalist anti-immigration force, namely Rupert Lowe's Restore Party. The jury's still very much out on that, in my opinion, but at least there's the possibility of some sort of genuine force breaking away from what I'd call the spiv politics of Farage and Reform. So there's all of that ferment going on that's causing tremendous problems for both of the mainstream parties. We might even have the Prime Minister resigning within days of tomorrow's elections. And again, a whole ferment going on. Now, in those circumstances, of course, I feature the elections from various perspectives in the current issue, and then we'll be looking at the outcome in the next issue as well, as to how local government is reshaped by these various challenges. But I think the important thing is for our listeners and for people old and new in the racial nationalist cause, not to despair and say, oh, there's hardly any candidates, everything's gone to pot. There are opportunities there. There are opportunities to join parties that are electorally focused, especially if they're active in your area, or even if they're not. And there are opportunities to contribute in non-electoral ways as well. I think the important thing is to do something. The important thing is to take that further step, the step beyond listening to streams like this, beyond going on Twitter, beyond going on TikTok or whatever, and you know, from being a consumer and reader and listener and sort of interested observer in our cause to becoming active in some way. Now, to an extent, it doesn't really matter in precisely what way you contribute, i.e. which group you're part of, whether you contribute to somebody putting out leaflets, donating money, writing, contributing content in streams and social media, that you do something, that you develop your ideas by reading. And that's one reason why we exist as a magazine, because as a magazine, it's possible to develop ideas at greater length and greater depth than you can do just with a meme or with a couple of sentences on Twitter. You know, if we could all just put out a couple of sentences on Twitter a few times a day. And yes, that would be raising consciousness to some extent, but people can just end up then just trapped in a cycle of talking to themselves. And reading a serious magazine, reading books, going to meetings, taking part in an election campaign, taking part in cultural activities of various kinds that are offered by the several different racial nationalist movements that exist. That's all developing you as a person, developing your interaction between you and your community, and building up your potential to contribute to our national and European renaissance. And that's, as I say, that's the main reason why we run a magazine, because we want to be able to play our part in the intellectual and political development of what we might as well truthfully call revolutionaries.
It's important to get involved in activity, whether it's community building or electioneering. I think one of the problems at the moment is Rupert Lowe's party is only standing in Great Yarmouth. I mean, I really like Rupert Lowe. He hasn't said anything that I disagree with. I check his tweets every day. And to me, I think he seems better than Nick Griffin, because Nick Griffin always seemed to be a little bit deceptive to me. And he was quite open that he was being deceptive, that he was going to say X, but what he really wanted was Y. And that, he still does it to this day. Whereas Rupert Lowe, it tells you exactly what he thinks. And I think he's being honest the way that he says it. But unfortunately, he's only standing candidates in Great Yarmouth. So I really hope that he does win in Great Yarmouth, because they're saying this is our testing ground. And if this works, we'll roll this out all the way across the country. So it's quite important that he wins. So I have high hopes for Rupert Lowe, if we put it that way. And I do see him as being different from Reform. Reform this week, they officially said that they would be open to a coalition, which would, of course, be with the Tories. And up until this point, Nigel Farage has always said, no, we will have no coalition with the Tories. So the fact that now he is saying, well, we might have one, that makes me think that the fact that Restore is there with Rupert Lowe, that's starting him to be a bit concerned that he might not win the next election. So he's wanting to form a coalition. And on the left, you've got the Green Party, which could possibly end up forming a coalition with Labour. So we could end up with two coalitions going against each other in a couple of years' time when we have the elections. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think the positive part of all this coalition multi-party politics, the positive part in the medium to long term for us will be if that leads to a change in the electoral system. Because if the first past the post system is kicked out, the wasted vote argument disappears. Depending on what type of system is introduced, you have the potential of having seats in the House of Commons even with less than 5% of the national vote. All of that possibility completely transforms the situation from the electoral point of view. And even those people within racial nationalism who say, well, we shouldn't be wasting our time in electoral politics, if we had PR and multi-party politics, they would probably then change their mind, because the situation would be completely different. Now, in the short term, of course, it also exposes people like Farage. Now, you mentioned coalition politics. There's a sense in which, of course, Farage's party, Reform, is already a coalition with the Tories itself. You only have to look at what you could loosely term the front bench or the leadership team of Reform to see that it's packed with Tories. Look at the council chambers up and down the country where Reform are in power or have a share of power in minority control of councils. They are either propped up by Tories in some cases, or their own ranks are packed with former Tory councillors. And this is a huge problem. It's a practical problem. It's a problem in terms of integrity. It's a problem in terms of ideology. Because let's not forget, the engine driving mass immigration in this country, it's not so much the Corbynist loony left, who were, for the most part, never in power nationwide. The engine driving mass immigration was international capitalism and the demand for cheap labour. And many of the people in the ranks of Reform UK and the Tory party are in the pockets, ultimately, of those same forces, those people who want international mass migration, whatever they might say about it rhetorically, and however much they might want to tweak it, fundamentally they're in favour of immigration because they're in favour of cheap labour. And we saw recently, my great friend and comrade in Spain just recently spoke last weekend at a rally in a sort of Madrid version of Brixton, where against mass immigration there. And what's happened in Spain, as some listeners will know, is that the Prime Minister has just introduced a policy to what they call regularise illegal immigration. More than 500,000 illegal immigrants will be given paperwork as part of this process and legalised. And part of the reason for that is that Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, is politically dependent on forces even further to the left than him. He's at the head of a coalition, a bit like you were saying about whether there'd be a Labour and Green and God knows what, Gaza independent or whatever coalition. That's the sort of coalition that Pedro Sanchez is in charge of. And that's why one of the reasons why my comrade Isabel finds herself in legal trouble over there, politically motivated prosecutions. It's also one of the reasons for regularising mass immigration, just legalising mass immigrants that their prime minister is doing. But the other reason is that you look at local level in Spain, and you see their version of the Conservative Party, the Partido Popular, is in many parts of Spain in favour of this regularisation policy because they want, especially in certain agricultural areas, some of those financial interests actually want mass immigration. They want cheap labour. And you've got to look very, very carefully at the type of people not only that Reform say they might go into coalition with, but the type of people they are in bed with already inside their own party, the type of people who fund them, the type of people that Farage welcomes onto his leadership team, the type of people who lead and take leading roles in reform councils up and down England, and I've no doubt after tomorrow's elections, when further reform councillors are elected, there'll be a whole fresh slew of these people. Now, in relation to Rupert Lowe, you might very well be right, but it's just very, very early days with Rupert Lowe. That's why I'm glad to see that there's a combination of nuanced responses within our movement, with some people actively joining up with Lowe's party, both online and in real life, as it were, and some people remaining sceptical and continuing to operate their own separate parties, the British Democrats and the National Rebirth Party, Homeland, and also in terms of broader non-electoral movements like PA, British Movement, and several others. So it's important to have that multifaceted response, because we just, for all that there are positive signs about how Lowe will develop, as you say, both in terms of practice right now, he only exists in Great Yarmouth. In terms of the electoral system, it might even be the case that his big moment, just like the big moment for the rest of us, could only come as a result of PR. because he will really need to kick on, you know, and need to kick on pretty quickly. If let's say, which is likely to happen tomorrow, Reform wins vast numbers of councillors up and down the country, and all Rupert Lowe's got is his group in Great Yarmouth, the next challenge is, at what point does he come out and take on Reform at local by-elections and even parliamentary by-elections? At what point does he risk this argument of splitting the vote? At what point does he take the political risks entailed in doing that? And if he doesn't, isn't there a risk that he just, given our electoral system, just continues to be overshadowed by Reform? So it's a very, very tough situation for him to be in. That's assuming, as you may very well be correct in saying, that it's assuming that he's entirely honest. However honest you are, there are certain political realities that you have to confront, and certain risks that you have to take. And so, as I say, the jury's out on that whole situation.
Well, just referring to Reform there, and you were talking about the connections that Nigel Farage has. Another of your articles, which isn't actually in Heritage and Destiny, I think it's on your own website, some research you've been doing, linking somebody who's very close to Nigel Farage with passing information to Hope Not Hate. Now, people may instantly be shocked at that, but even BitChute, they were asking Hope Not Hate to go through the videos on there and report ones to them that they thought were illegal. And BitChute thought, if we did this, we'll manage to keep functioning within Britain. But in the end, they had to stop. So they were sort of trying to use Hope Not Hate to flag these videos to them so they could remove them and stay within UK law. Now, I've also heard that the new candidates in Reform, that Nigel has had them being graded basically by Hope Not Hate to check that they don't have any past on Twitter saying ethno-nationalist things like this. So we have to bear that in mind. But also, there's not just Nigel's people close to Nigel that have been working with Hope Not Hate. There's also the Attorney General, who is connected to anti-fascists, violent anti-fascist militias, who is now the Attorney General. So could you talk about both those subjects? Because I think both of those actually dovetail in, yes.
Yeah, that's right. It's an extraordinary sort of connected story in a way, which is featured in two connected stories on the H&D website at the moment, and which in another context we'll be developing in the next issue of H&D when we look at the British connection to the story of the federal indictment in the USA of what you might call a sort of American version or an American style Hope Not Hate Searchlight type setup, namely the Southern Poverty Law Center, who do this business again of it's a tradition that goes back a very long way. And you can date it back to the American Jewish Committee in the 1930s and 40s, working with the U.S. government covertly to vet people. And in terms of the situation, the current situation with Hope Not Hate, Gawain Towler, no relation of Laura Towler, Gawain Towler, the veteran spin doctor for Nigel Farage, admitted this actually 2 years ago, speaking to The Spectator. He admitted that going as far back as the UKIP days and throughout the history of Farage's operation, he had, as he specifically put it in Towler's words, "We worked with Hope Not Hate to winkle out the fascists from our own ranks." And one of the guys in the press office was in touch with them just to double check. "We think this guy's dodgy. Is he on your list?" So their own staff would run names past Hope Not Hate, would cooperate on vetting to throw people out. He's a curious character, is Mr. Towler. The first, when I looked into him, the first political appointment he ever held was as lesbian and gay officer for York University Student Union. Although he later married, but his own daughter is a left-wing lesbian activist, a very strange character. And he became a right-hand man to Farage and is still now on the governing body of Reform. He's one of half a dozen people on the governing body. So that guy, that Farageist spin doctor, that Farageist chief lieutenant, Gawain Towler, he was admitting close cooperation between the Farageist movement and Hope Not Hate. But when we look at the Attorney General's case, that goes back much further still. That goes back to, in fact, roughly the same time as I was first coming into the movement, because we will probably be about the same age, the Attorney General and I. He's probably slightly younger than me, but only slightly. And he was a student in Manchester in the early 90s, a prominent figure in Jewish student circles and ultra-Zionist circles. And I've just put an updated article on the H&D site, including a video clip that was sent to us by an anonymous patriot, taken from Panorama in 1991, where this video actually shows the young Ricky Hermer, now Lord Hermer, now Attorney General, the closest ally of Keir Starmer, in closest personal friend that Keir Starmer has inside the present Labour government. Ricky Hermer, as a young Jewish student, was running martial arts training specifically for Jewish anti-fascists, and saying that his people would go out and target the fascists and fight the fascists both on the streets and sort of tracking down the fascists, as he put it. And the people he was working for, this was in an earlier stage of things, before Searchlight and Hope Not Hate went their separate ways. And he worked for Searchlight, in effect. And exactly what he meant by all this martial arts training, you can easily read between the lines, because he also ran his own Jewish student journal, and he gave that the title On Guard. Now, people who know the history of anti-fascism, that triggers a memory immediately and tells them exactly where Ricky Hermer was coming from. The fact he chose to call his magazine, chose to call his newsletter On Guard, because that was the name of the newsletter of the 43 group immediately after the war, an extremely violent Jewish organization that also had some communist backing as well, that carried out many violent attacks, particularly on Sir Oswald Mosley's post-war movement, and was funded and backed up by East End Jewish gangsters. And to some extent also had interconnections with the Zionist terrorist movements that were fighting against Britain at that time, both in Palestine and in London, you know, shooting people, planting bombs, etc., etc. So the 43 group had a crossover with the Irgun in particular. And it then developed in the 1960s into another violent, mainly Jewish anti-fascist group called the 62 group. And eventually the 62 group, part of it went straight, as it were, went respectable and became what's the Community Security Trust now. And another arm of the 62 group became Searchlight. So this is the family tree of violent, subversive anti-fascism. And the man who's now the Attorney General, Attorney General for England and Wales, and Advocate General for Northern Ireland, of course, is Ricky Hermer, Lord Hermer KC, is rooted firmly in that tradition. Back in his days in Manchester, of course, he was working with some of the most militant anti-fascists in the country. So I explain in the article that the people that were running militant anti-fascism in Manchester had ties both to Irish republicanism and to Salford gangsterism, the most famous gangster family in Salford, the Noonan family, were militant anti-fascists themselves. So that's the background. That's the political soil that the Attorney General grew up in, and that he was proud to root himself in. So it's no wonder we're in the position that we're in today, where patriots are like yourself, although to be fair, you were prosecuted before Herman became Attorney General. But it's no wonder that that situation has continued when Herman and people like him are occupying the highest positions in the land in relation to our legal system.
I find it amazing that he was quite openly talks about training anti-fascists in martial arts. If you were to have anyone that was any nationalist group that was training anyone in martial arts, they would be prosecuted. They would be accused of inciting violence, training people up for a race war, accused of terrorism. And yet here you have the Attorney General that was training anti-fascists in martial arts. And I also find it interesting that that's where the Community Security Trust comes from, which is headed by Gideon Falter. I think he might even be Sir Gideon Falter now, or Lord Gideon Falter. And he's often interviewed on GB News. And yet his organisation, the Community Security Trust, it comes from Antifa. Because I've seen him before, and obviously I don't agree with him, but I think he is a good advocate for Jewish people. He's doing the best that he can for Jewish people, and he's very good at it. But the fact is that the organisation that he comes from is started off with being violently anti-fascist, so it wasn't about being pro-Jewish.
Just 1 second, Sven. You may, before this is broadcast, you may need to check that, because I think, off the top of my head, I think Gideon Falter's group is another group again. Is a sort of a group slightly separate from the Community Security Trust that pursues an even more aggressive and paranoid agenda in relation to fighting anti-Semitism. So you might need to check that on Falter. As far as I know, Falter and the CST are two separate groups. But Falter himself, Gideon Falter is another good example of this phenomenon, because he first came to prominence, even before he formed an organisation, by targeting a Foreign Office diplomat. By a strange coincidence, he claimed with a friend to have been in a gym, obviously a fairly upmarket gym, in London, where this guy, from the top of my head, I think he was called Laxton, Rowan Laxton, this Foreign Office guy, was in the gym. Something about Israel came up on the big TV screen, and this guy Laxton supposedly said something anti-Zionist that Falter and his friend found to be anti-Semitic, and they reported him. And the whole thing was quite obviously a setup linked to the Israeli intelligence services. Wasn't just some coincidence that this guy, this militant Jewish activist, happens to find himself next to a senior Foreign Office official and accuses him of some anti-Zionist stroke anti-Semitic remark. The whole thing stank of a setup right from day one, and that was how he sort of built up his organisation, which of course was also the organisation that pushed heavily for a number of prosecutions, including the prosecution of Jez Turner and including the police pursuit of Vincent Renoir. So yeah, the connection between these people and between militancy of various kinds on the left, quite shameless militancy, and between that and organisations that might easily be suspected of links to the Israeli intelligence services, but then also connections between such people and the highest levels of British officialdom, all of that adds up to, I think, a very, very sinister and subversive picture.
Yeah, you were correct there, Peter. Yeah, Gideon Falter, he leads the campaign against anti-Semitism. They had him on GB News the other day speaking for the Community Security Trust. So he clearly does have something to do with them. But this is this Community Security Trust, they actually get £25 million a year from the British government. So for that to be going to this, this organisation that was openly violent, supported violence, violent Antifa, and then it becomes all about, it says it's about protecting Jews, when originally it wasn't about protecting Jews, it was about attacking non-Jews. That was the primary goal.
That was the root of it. If you trace back the family tree, and the significantly after, in the mid-60s, after Mosley's movement had sort of gone into, Mosley had gone into semi-retirement politically, there was a period of quiet, as you might say, between Mosley's movement disappearing and before the NF was created, when there were only relatively small parties. There was the original BNP, there was Colin Jordan's group, there was John Tyndall's group, but it was relatively small compared to at some other times. A bit like now, where there was no big racial nationalist force. So it was at that moment that what had been the 62 group, they sat down and said, look, how should we alter our approach? How should we evolve? And they were advised by a woman called Monica Medix, a journalist, Israeli intelligence officer, former Zionist terrorist herself from the 1940s period. In the mid-60s, she came to London with her husband, and she advised what had been CST, first of all, the 62 group, first of all to develop into a group called Jacob, and then eventually Jacob, what came out of Jacob was what's now the CST. So it was a strategic evolution on their part. And of course, what they hadn't realised at the time they started that evolution was that the National Front was going to appear, and that both the NF and BM and other groups were going to revive racial nationalism in the 70s. So once that had started, those same Jewish anti-fascists then, in addition to their respectable work, they also started up Searchlight as an intelligence organisation working with militant street-level anti-fascists in the 43 group and 62 group tradition, because they were sort of responding to changing circumstances.
Well, I'll just point out to our listeners that the 43 group and the 62 group, they're both discussed in detail by Mr. I in the interviews that we did with him quite a few years back now. You can find them on the Radio Albion website under British History. And Peter, thank you very much for coming on today. We could go on for a lot longer. I really enjoy talking to you. That's fascinating information that you always bring us. Do you want to just tell people where they can find your work before we finish?
Indeed, sir. Well, you can find the magazine at www.heritageanddestiny. That's all those three words combined, heritageanddestiny.com. And you'll find subscription details there. You'll also find some of my other work at realhistory, all one word, .info. And you'll find updates in both English and Spanish on the work that my great comrade Isabel is doing in Spain at Isabel Peralta, all those two words together, isabelperalta.net. And follow the links to find the versions in English.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Peter. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.